Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 249. It's Monday, March 4th. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, let's start with a landmark in global public health history. This from Stat News. More than 1 billion people worldwide have obesity, including 159 million young people, study estimates. More than 1 billion people, or 1 in 8 people worldwide, are now estimated to have obesity, a new study finds. Obesity rates grew particularly fast among children and teens, quadrupling from 1990 to 2022, the latest year the analysis looked at, while rates among adults more than doubled. That comes to 159 million children and teens with obesity and 879 million adults, according to the study published in The Lancet and conducted by the Noncommunicable Disease Risk Factor Collaboration, a group of researchers around the world. The new data highlight how the global burden of obesity is evolving. Obesity and other chronic diseases like diabetes have traditionally been associated with high-income countries, but they are increasingly affecting low- and middle-income countries as well, as those regions rapidly shift to industrialized lifestyles with diets of processed foods and reduced physical activity. And after obesity rates started rising among adults over the past few decades, the same trends are now occurring younger in life among children and teens. The analysis also looked at underweight rates, which fell over the past three decades. Large decreases in youth underweight rates occurred in South and Southeast Asia and Sub-Saharan Africa, but those regions still have among the highest rates of underweight in the world, the study found. The author said it's important to address the remaining issues of underweight alongside the increases of obesity, especially since populations can rapidly transition from being underweight to overweight, as both are related to having inadequate access to nutritious foods. Undernutrition and obesity are two faces of the same problem, which is the lack of access to a healthy diet. The authors urged officials to adopt policies that can address both, including improving nutrition early in life, such as by promoting breastfeeding, regulating food marketing, facilitating physical activity, and providing nutrition services in primary health care. So yes, both these are both forms of malnutrition, whether it's underweight or overweight. And as the world food system gets globalized into ultra-processed foods and we become increasingly sedentary, obesity continues to rise. Okay, well, next up, another nutrition story, this from CBS News. FDA to develop new healthy logo this year. Here's what consumers could see and which foods could qualify. The Food and Drug Administration could roll out a new logo as soon as this year for companies to stamp on the packaging of, quote, healthy foods that they make, aimed at clearing up confusion on what products actually should count as good for you. The new symbol will follow a long-awaited update to the FDA's definition, due to be published this April, of what foods can claim to be healthy to eat under federal rules. It comes as the agency is also working on another new major rule, front-of-package nutrition facts. What foods could qualify for the logo? Around 3% of manufactured foods are currently allowed to claim their food counts as healthy to eat, FDA Deputy Commissioner for Human Foods Jim Jones said. foods like raw fruits and vegetables will still automatically qualify to be healthy foods and could use the symbol. So there you go. That's about as good a sign as you can see for ultra-processed foods not being healthy and just highly processed foods. But the fact that you go in and look at any of the manufactured foods and you've got about 3% that actually will meet the requirement of, quote, healthy. And of course, that could be somewhat helpful, although a little bit depressing that it might be hard to find those healthy foods. But perhaps it'll bring a few changes in marketing. Some people try to capture that 3% and stick out. But of course, part of the problem is these labeling things are geared mostly to selling you their particular products, not necessarily bringing about healthy diets for all.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, well, next up, let's switch gears a little bit and ask an important question. Has the fall of Roe changed contraceptive access and use? New research from 4 U.S. states offers critical insights. This from Health Affairs Scholar. The overturning of Roe v. Wade in the 2022 Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization decision has had vast impacts on abortion access across the United States. But less is known about the wider impacts on people's contraceptive access. We draw on cross-sectional survey data representative of reproductive age women in Arizona, Iowa, New Jersey, and Wisconsin at 2 time points, one prior to and one following the Dobbs decision. We examine changes between these 2 time points in key sexual and reproductive health metrics and at the post-Dobbs time point. We found statistically significant evidence that sexual activity declined, barriers to accessing contraception increased, reports of receiving high-quality contraceptive care decreased, and condom use increased. As continued fallouts of the Dobbs decision on access to abortion occur, this research makes clear that access to broader contraceptive care is worsening. Policies that promote meaningful access to all forms of sexual and reproductive health care must be advanced to support all individuals' right to reproductive autonomy while mitigating inequity and inequality. And next up, in the changing landscape of abortion care, this from ABC News, abortions via telehealth medication have been on the rise. In the first nationwide count of telehealth abortions, researchers estimated that the number of such abortions had steadily increased over an 18-month period, and that in September, 16% of the abortions in the U.S. were done via pills dispensed by mail after consultations with virtual clinicians online. The findings about telehealth abortions echoes earlier research into the prevalence of medication abortions, which the Guttmacher Institute, a group that focuses on sexual and reproductive health, found in 2022 accounted for about half of all abortions. However, one of the key drugs used in medication abortion has been in the crosshairs of a legal battle over its use and regulation, with the matter soon to be considered before the U.S. Supreme Court. A federal appeals court ruled in August that mifepristone should be more tightly regulated than it is now, with limits on the drug at 7 weeks of gestation and requirements that patients obtain the pill in person instead of through the mail. What we know is that telehealth abortions within the healthcare system are extremely safe and effective. The safety and effectiveness rates are the same as in-clinic care and in-person care, said Dr. Montita Fleming with provider Hey Jane. So again, such limits by doing it in person is bogus as far as a health concern. It's more barriers being thrown up to accessible abortion care. Okay, well, next up, a story on a signature of American life, this from MedPage Today. School shootings in U.S. reach highest recorded levels. U.S. school shootings rose in frequency over the past 25 years and reached their highest recorded levels, data analyses show. Across the 1997 to 1998 through the 2021 to 2022 school years, there were 1,453 shootings, according to Luke Rapa of Clemson University. The number of shootings ranged from a low of 15 in the 2009 to 2010 school year to a high of 328 in the 2021 to 2022 school year. In the last 5 years of the study period, there were 794 school shootings, 135 more than the number of shootings that occurred in the previous 15 years combined, they reported in the journal Pediatrics. Gun violence in the United States is a public health crisis with severe consequences for the nation's youth, Rapa and his colleagues wrote. Children and adolescents directly exposed to violence and crime face a host of ancillary changes, including drug and alcohol use and abuse, depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, school failure, and involvement in criminal activity, they added. Moreover, youth indirectly exposed to are peripherally impacted through extensive media coverage of school shootings and school mass shootings. This leads to more people suffering the effects of these tragedies, with resultant outcomes tied to worsened mental health consequences among the members of communities in which gun violence occurs. Gun injury became the leading cause of death among children from birth to 19 years of age in 2019. In 2020, the U.S. was the only country among its higher income peers that saw guns as a leading cause of death among children and adolescents. Mass school shootings have not increased over the last 25 years, Rapp and colleagues note, but they have become deadlier. On average, there were 7.6 fatalities per mass shooting event from 1997 to 1998 through the period of the 2011 to 2012 school year, compared with almost double that at 14 fatalities per event from the 2012 to 2013 school year through the 2021 to 22 school year. Now, I must point out the earlier thing when saying that the U.S. school shootings rose in frequency over the last 25 years, that school shootings of any type, when they say mass school shootings have not increased over the last 25 years, but gotten more deadly, that's referring to where there's multiple deaths in mass shootings, not just all shootings as a whole, which is increasing. In an invited commentary, Rebecca Bell of the University of Vermont Children's Hospital pointed out that the mass shooting at Colorado's Columbine High School occurred 25 years ago. Since that time, billions of dollars have been poured into school security efforts, Bell wrote. Despite this, school-related gun incidents are growing, and the fatality rate of school mass shootings has increased, she observed. The data are clear that these tragedies cannot be prevented by focusing on school security alone, Bell added. Schools are extensions of our homes and communities and cannot be expected to be secure fortresses amid the easy availability of firearms. Pediatricians' efforts to make homes and communities safer also make schools safer. Intensifying our counseling and community collaboration efforts and advocating for research funding and policy changes are critical measures to stem the tide of increasing gun violence in schools. And of course, the most important statement there is that schools are extensions of our homes and communities and cannot be expected to be secure fortresses amid the easy availability of firearms. And of course, that's most importantly the easy availability of military-style, particularly deadly firearms. We have done better in the past. We can do better now. Okay, next up, have a story on alcohol-related deaths, which have been increasing in recent years and were jump-started by the pandemic. This from CNN. Excessive alcohol drinking drove about 488 deaths per day during the pandemic, the CDC says. In 2021, at the height of the COVID-19 pandemic, there were an average of about 488 deaths per day from excessive alcohol drinking, according to a new report from the CDC. Alcohol is a leading cause of preventable death. The average number of deaths related to excessive alcohol increased more than 29% from 2016 and 17 to 2020 and 21, said the report. During 2016 to 2017, there were about 138,000 alcohol-related deaths, but for 2020 to 2021, there were about 178,000 deaths, alcohol-related deaths. Researchers from the CDC and Canadian Institute for Substance Use Research captured 58 total causes of death related directly or indirectly to excessive alcohol use. Drinking excessively can lead to deaths directly related to alcohol, such as alcoholic liver disease, alcohol poisoning, suicide by excessive alcohol use, crashes and falls, and fetal alcohol syndrome, among others. Deaths can also be partially attributed to excessive alcohol use, such as chronic hepatitis and certain cancers, heart disease, and stroke. The increase in deaths related to excessive alcohol seemed to hit all ages, and although there were more alcohol-related deaths among men, the increase was larger for women. For women, excessive alcohol use-related deaths increased about 35% from the 2016 to 2017 period to the 2020 to 21 period, and death rates were highest among heart disease and stroke. Excessive drinking-related deaths among men increased nearly 27% in that same time period, with most of those deaths related to chronic conditions caused by alcohol. And that's an important point, is you can look at the traditional things that are more directly tied to alcohol, but a lot of those deaths are things from like heart disease, cancer, and stroke. The increase in excessive drinking-related deaths documented in this study is not an isolated trend. For the past two decades, deaths from excessive alcohol use have been increasing in the United States. Past studies have found that people bought more alcohol, particularly hard liquor and wine, during the early part of the pandemic. Binge drinking among adults between the ages of 35 and 50 in 2022 was higher than any other year during the past decade, other research has found. The new report mentions that more permissive policies allowed alcohol deliveries and carry out drinks during the pandemic made drinking more accessible. Some people may also have delayed getting help from a doctor or hospital due to their fear of catching COVID. Stress, loneliness, and social isolation and mental health conditions might also have contributed to the increase in deaths from excessive alcohol use during the COVID-19 pandemic, the report said. The authors suggest states should consider creating policies that will limit people's access to alcohol and increase its price, like by increasing certain taxes on alcohol. We know that there's a lot of evidence about what works to prevent excessive drinking and to reduce alcohol-related harm, but the strategies that we know work are often underused in the United States, said study author Dr. Marissa Esser from CDC's National Center for Chronic Disease Prevention. Making alcohol less accessible and less available by having fewer places that sell it or spreading out the number of places that are selling alcohol can help to create environments that support people's choice to drink less. While the new study focuses on excessive alcohol use, it isn't measuring the harms of all levels of alcohol use. Some studies have shown negative health impacts from any level of drinking. The CDC has an online tool available for people to assess their own drinking. If people do choose to drink, and most American adults do, the U.S. dietary guidelines suggest no more than two drinks a day for men and no more than one drink a day for women. That's to lower the risk of health harms, Esser said, although there is emerging evidence of additional harms that can occur at lower levels of drinking as well. Okay, well, let's switch gears and look at some environmental stories. This from the Environmental Health Network. EPA revises its approach to regulating natural gas plant emissions. The Environmental Protection Agency delays implementing emissions regulations for existing natural gas plants, opting for a more comprehensive review to include more pollutants. The EPA's decision follows criticism from environmental justice groups aiming for more comprehensive pollutant coverage in future regulations. New strategies will target the entire natural gas fleet and additional pollutants, offering a more robust approach to reducing emissions and protecting vulnerable communities. This move has stirred mixed reactions, with some environmentalists expressing disappointment over the delay and others seeing some potential for more effective outcomes. This move represents the EPA's strategic shift towards a more inclusive environmental policy, directly impacting health outcomes by aiming to reduce pollution in vulnerable communities. Recent studies have confirmed that the public health toll of oil and gas production is not limited to climate change. Yes, a lot of air pollution problems. So yeah, this is sort of good news, bad news. The bad news is that they're delaying the more limited regulations until they sort out more comprehensive regulations for the various pollutants related to burning, quote, natural gas, which is methane, which is a source for much of our electricity in this country, not a renewable source and a major contributor to climate change. And, of course, the burning of fossil fuels leads to a lot of particulate matter pollution, which can affect our health in great ways. This from the British Medical Journal. Air pollution linked to increased hospital admission for major heart and lung diseases. Short and long-term exposure to fine particulate matter, called PM2.5, which is particulate matter 2.5 microns or less. This air pollution is linked to an increased risk of hospital admission for major heart and lung diseases, find two large U.S. studies. Together, the results suggest that no safe threshold exists for heart and lung health. According to the Global Burden of Disease Study, exposure to PM2.5 accounts for an estimated 7.6% of total global mortality and 4.2% of global disability-adjusted life years, which is a measure of years lived in good health. After accounting for a range of economic, health, and societal and social factors, average PM2.5 exposure over 3 years was associated with increased risks of first hospital admissions for 7 major types of cardiovascular disease. Compared to exposures of 5 micrograms per square meter or less, which is the World Health Organization's air quality guideline for annual PM2.5, exposures between 9 and 10 micrograms per square meter, which represents the U.S. national average, which is 9.7, between 9 and 10, during this study period. And this was associated with a 29% increase in hospital admission for cardiovascular diseases. This means that if we were able to manage to reduce the annual PM2.5 air pollution down to the WHO level, we could avoid 23% in hospital admissions for cardiovascular disease. The researchers say their findings suggest that no safe threshold exists for the chronic effect of PM2.5 on overall cardiovascular health, and that substantial benefits could be attained through adherence to the WHO air quality guideline. This should not be surprising, as, of course, there's no safe level of, for instance, smoking. Yes, the more pollution you have, it produces harm in your body. On February 7th of this year, the U.S. EPA updated the National Air Quality Standard for annual PM2.5 level, setting a stricter limit at no more than 9 micrograms per square meter, which is a little bit lower than the 9.7 average over the study period of this study. This is the first update since 2012. However, it is still considerably higher than the 5 micrograms per square meter set by WHO. Obviously, the newly published national standard was not sufficient for the protection of public health, they add. In a second study, researchers used county-level daily PM2.5 air pollution concentrations and medical claims data to track hospital admissions and emergency department visits for natural causes, cardiovascular disease, and respiratory disease for 50 million U.S. adults aged 18 and over from 2010 to 2016. They found that short-term exposure to PM2.5 air pollution, even at concentrations below the new WHO air quality guideline limit, was statistically significantly associated with higher rates of hospital admissions for natural causes, cardiovascular disease, and respiratory disease, as well as emergency department visits for respiratory disease. Taken together, these new results provide valuable reference for future national air pollution standards. And of course, when it comes to toxins, the less, the better. Okay, well, next up, we've got a significant regulatory win. This from Medical Express. PFAS no longer sold in U.S. to package greasy food, says FDA. Regulators last Wednesday said materials from harmful chemicals known as PFAS are no longer being sold to package microwave popcorn or other greasy foods in the United States. Manufacturers have fulfilled a voluntary commitment not to sell material containing per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, PFAS, for use as grease-proofing agents in packaging that encounters food, FDA Deputy Commissioner Jim Jones said in a press release. This means the major source of dietary exposure to PFAS from food packaging, like fast food wrappers, microwave popcorn bags, takeout paperboard containers, and pet food bags, is being eliminated. PFAS, referred to as forever chemicals because of their lifespans in bodies and the environment, resist grease, oil, water, and heat. exposure to some types of PFAS have been linked to serious health effects. The FDA in 2020 got commitments from manufacturers to stop selling the chemical for food packaging to protect public health, according to the regulator. It was expected to take more than a year for the supply of food packaging with PFAS already sold to be exhausted in the market. So that's a little bit sad that they actually came to this agreement to get that out of the packaging in 2020. But it took years and years just recently to exhaust the supplies that were produced. And of course, manufacturers often with impending bans where they're given the ability to sell things that are in the pipeline, even ramp up production to be able to continue using and selling those products for even longer. But hey, I think you should be able to go to the store now or buy some of that fast food with those fast food wrappers or microwave popcorn bags or take out paper board containers and pet food bags that will likely not have PFAS in them anymore. Take what wins we can get. Okay, well, let's switch gears again and let's look at the prevalence of arthritis in adults age 18 and older in the United States in 2022. In 2022, the age-adjusted prevalence of diagnosed arthritis in adults was 18.9%. Women are about a third more likely to have arthritis than men, with women at about 22% of adult women, and about 16% of adult men have arthritis. Arthritis increases with increasing age from less than 4% in adults age 18 to 34 to 54% in those age 75 and older. The prevalence of arthritis also is decreased with increasing family income. So the poorer you are, the more likely to have arthritis. And those that are living in families with income less than 100% of the federal poverty level have about a 25% prevalence rate of arthritis compared to those with about a 17% prevalence of arthritis in those families that are living at an income at 400% or more of the federal poverty level. So the poorer families compared to the wealthier families are about 50% more likely to have arthritis. And also the percentage of adults with arthritis increased with decreasing urbanization level. I'll tell you, this is from the National Center for Health Statistics. They got a confusing way to put it. Basically, that means in the most rural areas, you have a prevalence of about 24% of adults have arthritis. And in the most urban areas, it's about 16%. Again, about a 50% greater likelihood of having arthritis if you live in a rural area versus a highly urban area. And this is all important because arthritis is one of the leading causes of disability in the U.S. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. And my personal guarantee to you is if you listen to this show for a year, you will know more about public health than 99% of the population. And if that should turn out to not be the case, I will refund triple your money. Okay, well, let's get to some more healthcare stories. This one from Axios. Medicare Advantage patients get less home health care. Medicare Advantage patients were found to get skimpier home health care and worse outcomes than their counterparts in traditional Medicare in a study published in JAMA Health Forum. So, of course, Medicare Advantage is the privatized version of Medicare. Why it matters? With more than half of Medicare beneficiaries in Medicare Advantage plans, I call them Medicare Disadvantage plans, there's growing concern about how the plans are run, including whether their guardrails around coverage are reducing access to care. Home health is a small but important focus because it can keep patients out of long-term care or nursing facilities. Medicare Disadvantage patients got fewer home health visits from nurses, therapists, and other classes of providers except social workers, and nearly two fewer days of services between admission and discharge, based on a review of about 285,000 patients who had care between 2019 and 2022. Their odds of having improved mobility afterwards were 3% lower than patients with similar needs in traditional Medicare, while the odds of improved self-care were 4% lower. Medicare disadvantaged patients also had higher rates of being discharged to the community, which combined with lower functional improvement could limit their independence and increase the burden on caregivers. The bottom line, differences in home health services can weigh heavily on Medicare disadvantaged patients, who are likelier to live alone with less support and often don't need the care until they're in dire medical straits. Yes, the upfront selling of these Medicare Advantage / disadvantage plans is like a lot of healthcare in America. It looks pretty good when you don't have to use it, but when you actually have to use it, in this case, traditional Medicare outperforms Medicare disadvantage. Okay, well, next up, a little different take on one of the risks in American healthcare is cyber attacks. This is from CBS News. Cyber attack on UnitedHealth still impacting prescription access. These are threats to life. A cyber attack on the health technology provider Change Healthcare is wreaking havoc nationwide, as some hospitals and pharmacies cannot get paid, and many patients are unable to get prescriptions. Change Healthcare says it processes 15 billion transactions annually, touching 1 in 3 U.S. patient records. I can tell you that this cyber attack has affected every hospital in the country one way or another, said John Riggi, National Advisor of Cybersecurity and Risk at the American Hospital Association. It's not a data crime. It's not a white-collar crime. These are threats to life, Riggi added. Change Healthcare says it has established workarounds for the payment, but more than 1 week after the hack was first detected, systems remained down, creating billing headaches for hospitals and pharmacies. Smaller hospitals are particularly vulnerable. UnitedHealth has not provided an estimate on when it believes the system will return to normal, and the FBI is also investigating. Okay, well, next up, the accelerating rise in drug prices. This from Reuters. Prices for new U.S. drugs rose 35% in 2023, more than the previous year. Pharmaceutical companies last year launched new U.S. drugs at prices 35% higher than in 2022, reflecting in part the industry's embrace of expensive therapies for rare diseases, a Reuters analysis found. The median annual list price for a new drug was $300,000 in 2023, according to the Reuters analysis of 47 medicines, up from $222,000 a year earlier. In 2021, the median annual price was $180,000. Huh, chump change. More than half of the new products approved by the FDA in 2023 and 2022 were for orphan diseases, meaning they affect fewer than 200,000 Americans, and some are not expected to become big sellers. The orphan rate is slightly higher than the 49% seen in the previous 5 years. A high price is justified for a drug with a lot of value to patients, but prices are just going up and up without any clear rationale as to why, said Dan Ohlendorf, Chief Scientific Officer at the Institute for Clinical and Economic Review, an influential group that evaluates the value and prices of medicines. He said many rare diseases and cancer drugs are not being priced relative to their benefit, but the lack of alternatives gives manufacturers negotiating leverage. Reuters analyzed 55 novel drugs approved by the FDA last year, up from 37 in 2022. The agency's biologic division approved 17 new products, including 4 gene therapies, which can cost millions of dollars for their single one-time treatments. The 2022 Inflation Reduction Act limits how much drug makers can raise prices for treatments offered under Medicare, the federal health plan for people age 65 and over. The legislation does not limit what can be charged for new medicines. It means you are encouraging companies to launch at high prices. Yep, always a workaround. Okay, well, next up, a story on the continuing blood shortage in America. This from Medical Express. Medical shortage imperils U.S. ability to treat patients who require blood on any given day. Our nation's ability to treat patients who require blood on any given day, for victims of mass casualty events to those undergoing treatment for cancer, is in serious peril, according to a new Viewpoint paper entitled The Bloody Transfusion Problem, published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Dr. John Holcomb, professor of the University of Alabama, Division of Trauma and Acute Care Surgery, and the lead author, paints a picture that extends beyond technical research into the economics, politics, and logistics of solving the country's problems surrounding blood supply and usage. These include the alarmingly inadequate supply of blood overall, alongside the need for shelf-stable blood products, the near absence of blood products available in pre-hospital settings, and the need to sustain consistent research funding for trauma studies of hemorrhagic shock, that's for blood loss. Key findings show that fewer than a third of hospitals which received blood components from the American Red Cross in 2019 routinely had platelets ready for transfusions. Among pre-hospital systems, including helicopters and ground ambulances, fewer than 1% have pre-hospital transfusion programs, and overall, throughout the United States, the rate of blood donation is falling. In fact, the Red Cross recently declared an emergency blood shortage and reported that the number of U.S. blood donors is at an all-time low going back 20 years. The consequences are amplified by a staggering amount of trauma. Currently, the leading cause of life years lost among people between 1 and 75 years of age and costing the United States billions annually. Well, I'll just highlight that interesting aspect of this is that having blood available in, quote, pre-hospital systems, which is, you know, ambulances and such, that has been shown to be very effective in saving lives, because if you're losing a lot of blood, you need to have that replaced very quickly. And that can massively reduce often very high mortality rates with those kinds of injuries. Well, if you would like to take a personal interest in this and do something about it, you are welcome to call 1-800-RED-CROSS and set up a blood donation. Save a life today. You can do it. Okay, well, that brings us to our last regular feature, bonus articles. A carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment. Available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give the link again at the end of the list. Have 30 bonus articles today, so let's get to it. First up, New Zealand's new government set to scrap world-first tobacco ban. So New Zealand was set to have the world's first tobacco ban, but they got a new government, and they're going to scrap it. So, of course, elections matter. Voting matters. Public policy matters. Bonus article 2. Closing the women's health gap would yield a $1 trillion annual dividend in improved lives and economies. So I've said it before and I'll say it again. The single greatest thing to improve health on this planet is to improve the status of women, which of course raises both the health status of women and men and children and improves economies, because a healthy public health is also good for the economy. A healthy economy in the public health way. I don't know. If we have an economy that destroys the planet, maybe that's not such a good thing. Okay, and a little bit also on a women's health issue. Bonus article 3, menopause is getting worse with each generation. What do we know? Well, there's a lot of still unanswered questions on this, except for the fact that this seems to be happening. But it also highlights one of the things is that since health research on women is not as well funded, doesn't get the same attention, it's a mystery that if you want to learn more about it, read this article, a good read. Bonus article 4, anti-abortion chaos is creating preventable health care crises. So the ill-defined, overly restrictive anti-abortion laws are creating all kinds of problems. You've got OB-GYNs in particular who are faced with ill-defined rules about what's the life of the mother and all this kind of thing, with very stark penalties, even criminal penalties. You can lose your medical license. You can go to jail for making the wrong legal decision, which is a fuzzy line meant to stifle abortion at all costs. And the cost is being paid by many women and their healthcare providers. Bonus article 5, how fertility coverage mandates could clash with IVF restrictions, IVF being in vitro fertilization. So this is in light of the moves like in Alabama and other places about a fetal personhood, where an embryo is considered a child. And this, there are some states that mandate fertility coverage, and there's some states that are basically doing huge restrictions on IVF, and this could be incompatible, so it can create some clashes. That's what this article is about. Bonus article 6, why discarding embryos is inherent to the IVF process. So if you want to understand in vitro fertilization and why the idea of not being able to discard embryos on pain of death, this it really can't work. So it's just a good process to learn some of the healthcare and the biology behind the IVF processes. Bonus article 7, transgender mental health status continues to worsen. So what can you expect if transgender folks are attacked, both physically, socially, and legally? It will have an impact. Bonus article 8, healthcare quality took a big hit during COVID, Medicare report finds. So the quality of healthcare, even though there was some more money and certain kind of stopgap programs put in, healthcare quality in the U.S., which is sort of lacking in the first place, a lot of holes there, took a big hit during COVID. Bonus article 9, high-cost cancer drugs without proof of added benefit are burdening health systems. So this is just another example in the kind of the free-for-all market-based drug development. You can actually get new drugs that don't actually have any proven added benefit, but are really expensive. So they make a lot of money, but don't necessarily add any health, but increase healthcare costs. Bonus article 10, new study links hospital privatization to worse patient care. So the profit motive that is more acutely played out in private hospitals leads to worse patient care. Bonus article 11, Medicare Advantage, or as I like to say, disadvantage, is bad for patients and bad for investors. I've done a lot of coverage on why it's bad for patients. This one sort of takes the bad for investors, because there's really this kind of sketchy game the system, unsustainable business model for trying to reap these profits is actually starting to run up to some of its own natural limits, both regulatory and hopefully through this show, people are learning that Medicare Advantage or Medicare Disadvantage perhaps isn't the best choice, unless you're going to be entirely healthy for the rest of your life into old age. Bonus article 12, money proves to be poor motivator for high quality medical care. This particular study just adds to the body of evidence that free market and profit-based solutions don't actually produce higher quality medical care. Things like actually caring about people, your patients, and developing incentives around a good working environment and being valued as a healthcare provider are much better than just adding money as an attempt to improve quality care. Bonus article 13, a litany of market failures, diagnosing and solving the economic drivers of antibiotic resistance. So this is taking a little bit of a different field of public health and medicine, and that is antibiotic resistance. But it's if you're kind of an economic geek, this is a good one. It covers 10 different economic problems, market failures in trying to solve the antibiotic resistance problem. So again, another good read, particularly if you're interested in the economic aspects. Bonus article 14, CVS to pay Ohio $1.5 million in penalties over understaffing and other safety issues at pharmacies. So CVS is the largest retail pharmacy chain in Ohio. This is the largest fine that's ever been given out by the Board of Pharmacy. That might not be saying much, but it's there has been so many complaints, dozens and dozens of complaints, often around understaffing. And this often leads to safety issues at pharmacies, among a myriad of other problems. And the worst performing, worst offending pharmacies are actually on kind of like double, triple probation and have to pay for their own monitoring over the coming years. So way to go, Ohio. I don't know if $1.5 million is going to be enough of a penalty to prevent a lot of bad behavior, but go regulators, keep an eye on what they're doing. And unfortunately, this is just a sign of the fact that pharmacies are one of the worst in our kind of capitalistic healthcare of driving people, overworking workers, and leading to all kinds of health issues. Bonus article 15. America worries about health costs and voters want to hear from candidates. So healthcare, particularly out-of-pocket expenses in its many forms, has been growing in recent years, and it's an electoral issue, and the voters want to hear from candidates. Not necessarily what you're hearing about, but it's a top issue. Bonus article 16. The 2023 to 2024 seasonal influenza vaccine is effective for reducing risk. So this is actually more effective than a lot of the flu vaccines have been in recent years. They typically run about 40-50%. This was on the high end of that, even in the 50-something percent for reducing basically having to seek medical care, the more serious cases of the flu. A big plus for the fact that flu shots help. Bonus article 17. Why are we still fluifying COVID? The diseases are nowhere near the same. So as a kind of an oddity on that front, is that people are actually more likely to get a flu vaccine than they are a COVID vaccine, even though, for instance, last year, 75,000 people died of COVID, and only a fraction of that many died of flu. But policy-wise, socially, it seems like the, quote, normalization, the ending of the COVID pandemic, we end up equating or fluifying COVID, where it is by far the most dangerous respiratory infectious disease around and continues to do damage. We're still at around 300 deaths a day from COVID. And on that same front, bonus article 18, CDC shortens COVID isolation recs. So this is basically syncing up COVID, a much more dangerous disease, along with basically flu and other respiratory viruses and infections, basically saying that you need to wait 5 days. You just need to wait till you don't have any symptoms or a fever for 24 hours before returning to work or school. On a little better note, the bonus article 19, the CDC advisory panel says people 65 and older should get a COVID spring booster shot. So this recognizes the fact that the COVID booster shots or booster shot, whatever you want to call it, another COVID vaccine, because they wane relatively quickly. And they do show quite a bit of efficacy on reducing severe disease and are very cost effective for people that are over age 65. In this case, it's definitely cost effective. So if you fit in that category, or particularly if you have one or more chronic conditions, get another COVID booster in the spring when they become available. Bonus article 20. Mounting research shows that COVID-19 leaves its mark on the brain, including significant drops in IQ scores. So we've known that COVID-19 ravages a lot of systems of the body, but the neurological system in the brain is one that's particularly insidious. And this new study, which is reinforced by a lot of other research, documents the fact that you're seeing cognitive dysfunction and including drops in IQ. And this is not just severe. This is people with very, quote, normal bouts of COVID and only moderate disease. Bonus article 21. For thousands of common chemicals, there is no safe level, says report by Endocrine Society. This is, again, just pointing out that these endocrine disrupting chemicals are something that really, if you, there is no safe level. So you have to be very careful. And the fact that there's so many of these, you know, regulating just one when you've got a whole class of chemicals, need to start dealing with on a more holistic basis. And on the similar line, bonus article 22, EU fruit and veggies increasingly tainted by forever chemicals. And these are the PFAS chemicals, which build up in your body over time and are hard to get out of your body. And unfortunately, the EU is seeing a large increase in the amount of forever chemicals that are present in fruits and veggies. And the bad news for us in the U.S. is that our regulatory environment is far more permissive than the European Union. Bonus article 23. Scientists confirm first case of bird flu on mainland Antarctica. So this is a landmark in bird flu. I did a story last week on bird flu sweeping up and down California, and they're really worried about it taking out mammal populations, sea mammals like seals and otters. And in that story, they were saying that they hadn't documented the fact that bird flu had hit Antarctica, one of the last remaining areas of the Earth that hasn't been hit by the bird flu. But here we have it this week. First bird flu documented on mainland Antarctica. Look out, penguins. Bonus article 24. Israel's campaign in Gaza is fueling demands to make ecocide an international crime. So this has been triggered by the fact that the Israelis want to fill up the Hamas tunnel networks with seawater, salt water. This could lead to a real problem with drinking water by salinization. It can also make lands unlivable as far as growing crops, for instance, if you salt the earth. And they want to add this as one of the elements of an international crime, ecocide. You know, that's all we need is more sides in the world. Bonus article 25. Quite radical. The feeling of exhaustion is key to tackling climate change, says author. So this is an author who wrote a book about climate exhaustion and just exhaustion in general in modern life. It's a good read just to see how we can parlay some of those feelings that we normally see as negative, but can actually be a stepping stone to action. Bonus article 26. Ultra-processed foods linked to 32 health problems. What to know? This is just a good overview. I've covered a lot on ultra-processed foods, and this is just a summary of some of the current research where we're at. Bonus article 27. How Americans view weight loss drugs, and obesity in the U.S. So this is a good perspective on just seeing that, particularly with these weight loss drugs, Americans don't particularly see that as being a panacea. But also it gets at some of the stigma and the over-focus on individual actions versus community-wide social determinants of obesity that are present in the U.S. and elsewhere in the world. But if you're concerned about your health related to eating, bonus article 28 gets at one aspect of that. The pros of early time-restricted eating. So I've talked about time-restricted eating before. That's when you fast for 12 hours or more, such as overnight. If you're not snacking right up to the time of bedtime, most people can do that. It's not that difficult. But this one specifically talks about early time-restricted eating, meaning eating your food earlier in the day. If you give people the exact same food, but you space it out differently, people are healthier eating it earlier in the day rather than later. So bigger meals, you know, lunch and breakfast as opposed to the dinner, evening time meal, and not eating later in the evening. Good for your health. Bonus article 29. High-intensity exercise can reverse neurodegeneration in Parkinson's, study suggests. So this is a fascinating study. Partly, this is really a relatively small study, but very provocative, because it actually reverses the neurodegeneration in Parkinson's by doing this high-intensity exercise. But this wasn't crazy levels of exercise, but it was high-intensity multiple times during the week. But the fact that that could reverse a degenerative neurological disease like Parkinson's is pretty exciting. And also just wanted to highlight the fact that exercise can ameliorate a lot of ails in our health. So go exercise. Last but not least, bonus article 30. Health is political. Americans are divided. How the new CDC head aims to fix that. So this is talking about some of the areas, hopefully, of common ground. Two that she points out are mental health and young families. Let's do it. Let's move forward. You can view these and all the other stories I've reported on in this show and previous episodes by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-